So we had a boom box that had two mics. They were condenser mics, but you had levels. You could set the level. So Meyer Threat would get into the argument. Jeff, who was in charge of the tape deck, would turn up the input all the way so you could get the actual the argument. But the problem is that inevitably somebody would like hit a bass note or a guitar note and just, you know, just
overload. It's great.
Right. So I have these great recordings of arguments, but then you turn it up and it's just peppered with these extremely loud blasts of sound. So I've gone through and actually edited out, trying to make it so you can actually hear it with the volume all the way up.
That's pretty amazing.
They're good arguments.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Funf. Boy, has there ever been a more fun way to say five than funf?
Yeah, when you want a number to sound like a intestinal problem, funf is your answer.
Funf. It's like a Mad Magazine Al Jaffe noise.
Totally. It's like glitch or, yeah. Here we are.
Here we are. Amy Mann.
On a Tuesday afternoon, just like this song.
You're supposed to say Ted Leo back to me.
Ted Leo.
You just did it like in the song. That was nice, actually. Ted Leo. Recording our podcast intro today. It's raining in Rhode Island and it's raining in L.A.
In L.A. Key change.
I forgot the key change.
Everyone turns it off. Podcast gets turned off. Ted Leo, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm okay. Very busy. Very overwhelmed.
Yeah, very busy. Me too.
Yeah. Wait, was I singing the wrong song?
Tuesday afternoon.
Oh, I was singing.
No, that's the right one. Moody Blues.
Oh, yeah, the Moody Blues is right.
There can't be two.
No, that was the right one. I was just, no, I'm wrong. I'm right and wrong.
I mean,
we're both right. I am additionally wrong.
This is perhaps the time to remind you that I was in a band called Till Tuesday.
I have never forgotten.
It was clearly a period of infatuation with sticking days of the week into songs. I had a song called Maybe Monday, and then a song called On Sunday. I didn't get through the whole week, but I feel like maybe, you know what?
Yeah, the first three.
For the next both record, maybe we should
pick it up with Wednesday.
We should pick it up with Wednesday, and then obviously there's only so many days of the week, but we could have like weekend, evening.
I'm into that idea. I like the challenge of actually using evening in a way that's not going to be gross.
Like making love in the evening?
Yeah, exactly. That kind of gross, yeah.
Oh, Ted. So I've been, you know, when I'm getting ready in the morning, making coffee and washing dishes and that kind of thing, I listen to like bread radio because, you know, you and I went through a whole bread phase of rediscovering the greatness that is bread. And over time, the bread radio sort of incorporated other 70s stuff like Steely Dan, who I love, and, you know, a variety of things. And, you know, so it's giving me this impression that the music of the late 60s and early 70s was great, right? It was all great.
Oh, right.
So I decided to, you know, find like a playlist that was all, like top 100 of, say, like 1970, and just play it like, this is going to be great. All these songs that were hits in 1970, it's going to be fantastic. And you just realize that 90% of all music at any given time is just terrible. And it's just miserable. Like there's the novelty songs that are grating and annoying. Mm-hmm. Also, the other thing is interesting that like in 1970, you think that it's going to be like all sort of hippies or like, you know, folk music and Dylan inspired and that kind of thing. And it's really not. Like a lot of it is, you know, like Tie a Yellow Ribbon, like it's almost got like a like roots in vaudeville more than Beatley or hippie or any of that stuff.
Right. I mean, that was the era of Little Willie, Bubblegummy Power Pop.
Yeah, Bubblegummy, but like, you know, well-crafted songs, but in a real certain style. But you and I were talking about this the other day, that there's a type of rock song in that era that was like the spooky lady,
mm-hmm.
the evil witchy spooky lady song.
Right. And, witchy woman, spooky.
Spooky. I kind of a long, cool woman in a black dress. I would include that.
And I would put, maybe not necessarily in the lyrics themselves, but vibe-wise, I would put green-eyed lady in there.
Totally. And like evil woman, like actually, oh, we just came out evil and said woman, it. Yeah. Evil woman, yeah.
Now, my initial thought also was to put Heart's Magic Man in there, but I think maybe that's the flip side of the coin. That's the feminist response to the hippie free love hangover, which is blaming all its subsequent troubles on being bewitched by the women of the scene.
Yeah, exactly. I really do think that there's something in like the witchy woman songs that feel that their attraction to a woman has to be about something that she is doing that is supernatural, because they cannot take any responsibility or ownership of their own feelings.
Right, or actions. I mean, look.
Yeah, or actions, yeah.
We don't have to get too dark here, but beginning with Love Potion number 9, during which the protagonist runs around town just kissing people. You know, he kissed the cop down at 34th and Vine, or 9th or whatever, Vine. I mean, you go through to the Hollies Stop All the Dancing, and this is grim, but there's an actual, like, I can't deal with that song. It's an actual assault, and it's the bewitching dancing of the woman that has drawn him to do it.
Yeah, and Gary Puckett, Young Girl.
Oh, yeah, Young
Girl.
You
know, like, Young Girl, get out of my mind. Yeah. My love for you is way out of line. It's way out of line.
Yeah, and it's your fault. Get out of my mind, Young Girl. Yeah. You're much too young.
And she's like, I'm 16. I don't know what you want me to do. change classes? Gary, like what? Yeah.
change homeroom.
I can't change homeroom.
Gary Puckett and the Union Gap also have Lady Willpower.
Oh my God.
Which is, again, essentially like, don't make me assault you.
Ugh. Yeah. I wish I could say things were different then, but it is interesting to realize like that there was a theme, and the theme kind of betrays an attitude. Anyway, so that's what I've been doing with my morning since we last spoke.
That is a great way to start the day. Just filled with fear and anger and disgust and a tarnished vision of one's younger days and the music one remembers.
The worst of it are like the novelty songs are so wildly irritating. Mm. There's this one called Playground in My Mind.
Right.
And it's got these children singing, and it's just like, listeners, please look it up and see if you agree with me that it is the most annoying thing you've ever heard. All of that has nothing to do with our next guest.
Well, it makes sense that right around that time, there was a severe pendulum swing into what we now know as punk rock.
Severe pendulum swing. The one of the big takeaways that I got from talking with Ian is that his process really derives from his moral sense about how he should treat people. And that was really interesting to me. And he's like really, he's really dedicated to it. Like he thinks about stuff and considers, the implications of everything. I mean, not unlike our Ted Leo.
Well, I would, I would count Ian and I are old friends, but I would count him as an influence on me in a big way, in that exact way, I think. The interview is interesting. As I was editing it, I realized that there are very few straight answers to questions that that Ian gives us, but he's incredibly generous with his storytelling, and he's lived such a long life that I think I was content to just sit back and listen to a lot of it. But what I noticed did come out, as you're saying, talking about his moral compass, there are actual answers to the processy questions that we usually ask that come out through a lot of these storytellings. Like we were talking about perfectionism and limitations, and when you put that in a moral context, how that influences how you work and what you do. And he was talking about the Minor Threat song Cashing In, which was sort of jokey about them being accused of selling out. And he was saying, these limitations I place on myself, they influence how I think about, how I operate in the world, but not about songwriting. But then I thought to myself, and I wish it had occurred to me in the moment, I was like, but you did write a song about it.
Yeah.
You know, so these things continue to come out. We always ask about practice and things, and there's no real straight question to answer about that, but he does talk about how important it is when you have a body of work to just get out there and play it, and that's how you gain mastery and muscle memory and etc.
And almost like a moral dedication to the idea of being a musician all the time, regardless of who's listening.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, always writing, playing with other people.
Yeah.
And that it's a shared experience. Like, he's very serious about having the experiences be shared.
Yeah.
With other writers. I've found him to be a very generous person, and also like not didactic, you know, like not, you know, not sort of self-righteous or didactic, but just somebody who's very caring. And you know, it's really refreshing.
That comes out as what I think could be considered the moral of this episode, is that shared experience thing. Toward the end, he talks about how even the very conversation that the three of us are having, which of course begins in our shared history and love of music, is in a way the entire point of why he loves making music, because it leads to human connections and even specifically conversation that then reinforms music and et cetera. You know, it's nice.
Yeah, it was very inspiring.
There are a lot of bands that get mentioned over the course of the episode, and I'll put links to some of those that I can find. You know, some video clips and things in the show notes. Of course, we didn't even mention, but we should for those who don't know, that Ian MacKay, our guest for this episode, scion of Washington D.C. And American hardcore punk scene. He started Discord Records in the 70s and has been in a lot of bands that in that world have been hugely influential. Minor Threat, Fugazi, of course, his current project with his wife Amy and Joe Lally from Fugazi.
Ian MacKay. Is there a theme, an argument theme that comes up over and over? Your idea is dumb.
It was usually, it started with songwriting or it was political. I was really in charge of, or in my mind, really trying to look out for the band, how we approach things, what we did, there's an argument we had about when we did the Out of Step record, we had written a bunch of new songs, but not a whole album's worth, we didn't think. So the question was, should we include the song that were on the single, re-record the song on the single? Like, should we flesh out this 12-inch, or should we make it an album? And there was a lot of arguing about that.
Yeah.
Like, I was really against repeating the songs. I felt that was a ripoff.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, because I'm looking out for the kids, right?
Yeah.
And,
yep.
And then Jeff at one point, he suggested, well, maybe we could do like one side would be the new song, the other side would be the old songs. And then Brian and Lyle were upset about that, because if we're not going to do that, we're not interested in having our songs sort of split into two different camps. Then there was this whole other issue of, there was a song called Cashing In that's on the Minor Threat record that was written as a sort of a joke song.
Mm-hmm.
Minor Threat had broken up when Lyle went to college in 1981, September 81, he went off to Northwestern and we broke up. Cause that's, you know, we'd been together for 7 months or something. And
you know, it was time.
And at that point, that is the lifetime of a band.
Right, that was it. Yeah. But also, like, he was leaving. That was that. So, and, you know, we had put out one record at that point, the single, which was, we'd sold 1,000 copies. We were, you know, great. Fantastic.
He had a full career.
Yeah.
Right. So then we reformed. I mean, I should tell you the story about the reforming. It was crazy because Brian Baker was playing bass. He started playing in Government Issue. So he was playing. And then Jeff and I were working on another band, which was called either Grand Union or Skewball, depending on who you asked what it was going to be called. But that band never came together, really. And at Christmas time, around Christmas, late December, the Bad Brains played the 930 Club, and they had just returned from their first U.S. tour. And HR, the singer of the Bad Brains, said, "Yo, Ian, man, you got to get out to California, man. People love your band." I said, "Well, we broke up." He's like, "Well, you got to get back together because you started something. People got questioned. You got to give them answers." I was like, "You know, yes, sir.
Yeah.
You know, yes, sir.
People have questions."
Yeah. I mean, so then so as it happened, because it was Christmas, Lyle was home from college. So I said to Lyle, you know, I told the band, like, that's what, you know, HR said. And Lyle said, "Well, you know, I hate school. So I'm all for it." So it was decided that we would reform around Easter. Lyle came home from, that's when he dropped out of school. But when the word got out that we were reforming, there was a lot of upset within the scene.
Oh my God.
People felt like it was like we were selling out. And also I had done an interview in which I said clearly that I felt like once a band, someone leaves a band, then that's the end of the band.
Yeah.
Do something new. I feel like there's mitigating circumstances here.
Agree.
We were all younger. And so there was a lot of either outright anger or people were critical of us, or it was something that I was insecure and we felt people, there was a sense, it was implied.
That, yeah.
So there's a song that was like a jokey rock and roll song and I wrote some lyrics and then we thought, oh, we should just do this as our first song. It's called Cashing In. Like, here we are cashing in, which just seems so absurd that we would be cashing in because we are a tiny band. We might get 100 people come to our shows, which a couple hundred people. And the idea that we were like, this is a big money play seemed absurd. So we wrote this song and we did it. The first song we played when we reformed, we did the song. We opened for the Bad Brains at the 930 Club on April 29th, 1982. And we came out and we actually threw money in the crowd.
Oh my God.
And fantastic. It was obnoxious. You know, we were defensive. We were obnoxious. Anyway, so the song was done as a joke, kind of a one-off. But then it was decided that when we recorded, they were really keen to record the song. And I was really against it because it was a joke and I didn't want to rip off the kids. That was my thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I agreed to record it, but it wasn't going to be listed on the record.
Right.
So if you look at the Out of Step 12-inch, it doesn't say Cashing In. It was not on the record. It wasn't until CD technology came on where it forced you to have index points. Yeah. It suddenly had to come to light that it was actually a song. We also put on a second version of the song Out of Step, which was supposed to be a clarification because so many people misunderstood.
People had questions.
People had questions and
they needed trying to give answers.
Yeah. So there was this whole...
It's a whole brouhaha.
Right. So the second one has a clarifying in the instrumental break in the middle of the song. I say, like, it's not a set of rules. You know, for the record, that was 1982. I was trying to get that shit cleared up.
It kind of segues into, you know, the podcast is really about the role of form and structure in creativity. And so one of the things we talk about is perfectionism and how that can get in the way. I definitely know songwriters who the biggest struggle is writing a line and then not immediately judging it and throwing the whole thing out. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there was definitely a place of perfectionism that you started out. I mean, it's hard not to do that when you're young. You know, you feel like everything you do is going to represent you till the end of time.
Yeah. And can I add also that, well, first of all, we're talking about, 8 months between the breakup and the reunion,
mm-hmm.
you know, which these days just seems kind of insane that it would cause that much of a furor. But I understand because I think at the time, if I'd have gone through that and gotten that kind of pushback, I wouldn't have even been able to joke about it.
I mean, I felt like I could see the absurdity of it. I also understood it. The thing about that is I wasn't thinking about the end of time. Like, I'm never worried about my image to the end of time. What I was interested in was the actual dialogue within the community, because punk rock for me was clearly an extended family.
Yeah.
Like, and they were important people. So the fact that people who I was close with were upset with me or felt like that I was doing something that was not on the up and up, whatever, it was upsetting. But also, frankly, within any kind of community, any kind of scene or clique or whatever you want to call it, there are some people who are obnoxious. People do shitty things.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean they're bad people. It just means that's part of the dynamic of the group. And so there are people, you know, there are times where we did something that was obnoxious. I mean, I definitely have done things. I did things at the time where I'm like, well, that probably wasn't the best way to approach that situation.
Yeah.
But it's a learning process. I mean, we were literally kids. I mean, in that year, I was 20, which is, I guess, technically an adult. But
it's pretty young.
Yeah, but, you know, but most of the people coming to shows were, you know, 15, 16, 17 years old. And we were all evolving together, trying to figure out how it worked, life, you know, like how we were. So at that time, I think the intensity of that, it wasn't really about songwriting or it wasn't about like our profile or our brand. It was about navigating the relationship of
like
a
rules
family.
Of behavior.
Yeah.
Your just rules like a moral code, really.
Of course. Yeah. And I felt like the moral code was important. Like I felt... Like, for instance, I really strongly believe that, like, we were from Washington and we weren't going to move to New York. You know, I felt like because everybody else was like, we're going to go to New York to make it. And I was like, fuck that.
Yeah.
Like, I want to stay here, you know. And also, as a punk, I really rejected the idea of the music business. I just thought it was, I thought that profit and money got in the way of true creativity and true like community. I really was concerned about sellouts. That bothered me. And I used to also remember seeing, you know, I'd run into people who I was a fan of their band and they would be so uncool.
Yeah.
They'd just be so, and I just thought, like, this sucks.
Yeah.
Like I will try never to be like that in my life, you know? So it was important to me. So I think that I was a little roughshod, but I was really trying hard to do well and do right. Like that's what I was thinking about, you know, just do it right. And and also part of it was an art of necessity because we didn't have any other way to do it, you know? But I mean, there were certainly people, like I remember when the first interview I ever did, I was playing bass in the Teen Idols and a woman who was, I think she may have actually been, went to my high school, but she was a couple years ahead of us. But she interviewed me for, I don't even know what it was for, maybe a local music paper. And one of her questions was, so are you in a band for the money or the girls?
Oh my God.
And I was completely flabbergasted because it never occurred to me that anybody would play music for money or for girls.
Yeah.
It just was such a weird, but I realized later on that in fact, you know, people did do stuff like that. And there was a lot of really kind of, I found, you know, squalid behavior going on surrounding that.
Yeah.
And I was really interested in being declarative about how I was not what I was involved with. We were about music. That was my idea. Music and like the gathering point. That's what we were about. That was the idea.
And that's really interesting to me because it's a moral code and a belief system that then sort of dictates a whole musical behavior.
It seemed to, so I think at that point, but then in terms of songwriting, I would agree with you about, like, I've often said that the only good song is one that someone actually hears.
Yeah.
So I know a lot of people who have, like, you know, their songs are they're never good enough. They keep working. They're so they're perfectionist in a way. They spend so much money. They keep thinking, like, if I do a better recording. And I'm, you know, I think a great song can survive a terrible recording.
Yeah.
I mean, listen to Louie Louie, right?
Yeah.
But a bad song, it doesn't matter. The better the recording, the bigger piece of a shit it is.
Yep. Yeah.
It just sounds worse and worse and worse.
The more polishing.
Right. Right. So I feel like that when people are being perfectionists and throwing money at stuff, I say to them, like, you know, the only good songs in the world are the ones that people can actually hear. So, I mean, if you want to tinker, great. But if you're just trying to get it perfect, this is not going to work.
Yeah.
It's just never going to work. I'm pretty, compared to other people, I'm pretty much like, that'll do.
Yeah.
Let's get it out there,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, I can tell you, if we sat and listened to my record, I'd say, well, that I could have done, this could have been better. I mean, some of the songs, I listened to recordings, I'm like, oh, man, that song hadn't really been realized yet, which is another great irony of recording is that quite often, when you first start playing, you may have done a bunch of gigs and you go in the studio to document this body of work. But this body of work has been written and played and worked out.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you do your second record, you're like, I have to write some songs. And then you go in the studio. The songs have not even had a chance to grow up.
Yeah.
They just are still in this weird infant stage. And then when I hear some of our, like Fugazi's songs, I think, wow, the song's not ready.
We'll return right after this break.
Everything about the music industry, the music business, is usually, in my mind, reversed. You know, everything is backwards. You know, like I think labels will put out a record, or bands want you to put out their record so they can start something, like get something going. I want bands to go out and get something going so I can document it.
Yeah,
it's just a different way of thinking about the music business.
Within the number of bands that you've been in, going from what is of necessity going to start out that way, like we're just trying to document this thing that we're doing, to actually having some acumen of what a studio can do for you, how you can work in a studio, how you can get what you want out of a studio, from Minor Threat to Embrace to like Fugazi, et cetera. I mean, because I know a lot of the other people who are in those bands, I know that they also have different relationships to the studio. Mm-hmm. How did that affect writing and recording with, let's just say, Fugazi? Were there different ideas about how much time to spend on things? How much?
Well, don't forget that I had done so much production work to begin with.
That's true. You recorded a lot of bands yourself.
I mean, I produced. That was actually the most interesting thing about Fugazi is that when we first went into the studio, I naturally sort of sat in the producer's chair because I had produced everybody's records.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a discomfort because suddenly, like, there was a conflict of interest because I'm in the band.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons that we asked Ted Nicely to come in. Just because we needed a referee, somebody else, because we just couldn't. I don't think it was really a matter that, like, who's going to make his guitar too loud, but just really we need somebody else to be in the picture.
Yeah.
I say with Fugazi, over the years that we recorded, all of us felt like we were just going to try to do a straight documentation. Nobody was being super studio. We did know that our live, we had it pretty well dialed in. So we were just trying to make that happen in the studio. We also did come, we studied hard. We studied a lot of music and we were all very serious, like for instance, Beatles fans. We understood that if you look at the Beatles trajectory, you can see a moment in time where suddenly the studio became part of their writing process.
Right.
Like at the very beginning, it was like these really incredibly well-recorded songs, just in terms of like being faithfully documented. And then at some point, they turn into these much more, like the creative palette changed because they start thinking about the way you could use a room or the equipment involved. I think that Fugazi had a similar sort of point in time where in the beginning, we were just trying to like get it down on tape what we were doing live because we thought that was good. It never really worked because live is just such a different experience. Recording, of course, is sonic illusion. That's what's happening there. Is that we're
illusion or allusion?
Illusion.
Right.
It's an illusion because what you're trying to do is you're trying to bring about within people a reaction as if they were at a show or something. But at a show, you're in a room with other people, and you have the temperature, the air is like the you have like the vibration, yeah. You have these giant speakers, you have like
the smell of sweat,
right?
Beer.
All this stuff, everything that's going on, you have this sort of whole energetic thing. It's like this like cathartic thing that can happen, but you're trying to get that out of, at the time, like little 5-inch speakers in the back of a car, or now,
quarter-inch
or earbuds, so it's really a sonic illusion. Like you're creating something. It is a laboratory. Mm-hmm. And it's also ironic because for a punk band, or at least for the band, we were, our shows were so visceral, and then we were trying to make this thing happen, but you're doing it essentially in a very clinical setting, right?
Yeah.
It's very, everything is clean and kept, dusted and all that. And also, it's not quite as bad as, I think, playing on television. I mean, have you guys done, like, TV shows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where you're just like, okay, go. And they're like,
it's you have the to be, worst.
Like, get into it
freezing.
Immediately.
It's literally
right, it's also,
the
like,
worst.
42
yeah.
degrees.
Yeah, it's
right.
freezing.
Yeah, it's 42 degrees.
It's freezing
and
dry.
And it's like, and also the atmosphere is exactly, like, the people in the crowd are like,
who are
okay,
you?
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so it's not quite as bad as that, but it's similar because you have to kind of get a certain head of steam up, but also you're aware of the fact that you can second guess it. So when you play live, like when you a note played is a note laid. That's it. You can't take that shit back, right? But in the studio, especially now, you can second guess it, third guess it, 100th guess it. You can keep tweaking. Or you could just, in the early days when you were doing 4-track stuff, you just go like, oh no, yeah, that's not a good enough version. You have to do it again and again and again and again and again because you could second guess it. But live, there was maybe once or twice where we did a song so poorly that we're like, we should just do that again, just because that was just sucked.
Yeah. What's your relationship to a note played, a note laid? Like, does that get in your head ever if there's a major clam?
Live?
Yeah.
No. The only times... Really, the only time I've really struggled, like there's been certainly, I've made some mistakes, but very occasionally, it's only happened once or twice where I can't remember a lyric. That is weird because everything for me is like, it's a linear muscle memory.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when I start playing, like I just need to start and then my hand and everything else, I'm not thinking about it.
Yeah.
But if I miss that entry point,
it's
really
the
lost.
Worst.
Yeah.
I've done it many times. I've done it many times. And then it snowballs and then you get freaked out and then you forget the next one. And you're like, all right, there's only so many times I can make a joke out of this and start again explain to the audience. And, before it starts to get like a Loretta Lynn like breakdown on stage. Yeah.
It's true. I remember we did a show. We were in Brazil in Curitiba. And we did 3 nights at this place called 92 Growls, 92 Degrees. But anyway, we were doing song number one, which is like one of the first songs I ever wrote with a band. I've played it a million times, but just came back from the break and I just couldn't remember it. We're just playing the part. They're all looking at me like, are you going to start singing?
Man.
And I'm like, and I said to Gia, like, I don't remember the words. He's like, what the fuck, man? We've done this song. I remember another time, the Palladium, this is not me, but it was Joe. We were doing Promises, a song Promises, and there's an intro section, and then the bass shifts into what becomes the verse of the song. And we're playing the Palladium in LA, and there's like, 4,000 people there, and Joe just cannot make the shift.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And he just keeps playing the intro part, and he's looking at me like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I'm just going to look at Kingdom, and I'm trying to vamp, you know, like, yeah. Promises, woo, yeah, promises. Like, words. But those kind of moments, that's the only time. But in terms of making mistakes, like, whatever.
Yeah.
He's behind
let,
me now.
You let it go. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I talk about this a lot. There was a movie called Gumball Rally.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
Remember that movie? It was a 70s stupid kind of, what do you call it?
Pre-Cannonball Run.
It's an ensemble movie about a bunch of rich people racing from one coast to the other. Mm-hmm. One of the guys gets a little Ferrari sports car, and he hires an Italian guy to drive it, a race car driver. So they get in the car, and the driver, the Italian guy, the first thing he does is he reaches up and he snaps the rearview mirror off and throws it out of the car. And he goes like, what was that? And the Italian guy says, what is behind me is not important. And I've always thought that's like a really, and that, you know, and the funny, I've told that story so many times, and recently I looked it up on YouTube, and the scene is on there, and it's not what happened.
Oh, really?
But I like it anyway.
It's similar, but my
version of it is much. It makes more sense.
Your takeaway, yeah.
Although now I have to look at it again to think.
It's
maybe
a solid takeaway, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought that's a bit. You know, that was a big problem. Like, I do have to work on that.
Yeah.
Every show, making a mistake and going, "Let it go, man, because it's gone."
Like, I've had bad shows.
Mm-hmm.
Where I just felt like I let down the other people in the band.
Yeah.
But in terms of, like, you know, what people thought of me, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, there's you don't want to let down your audience, but you also have to give your audience a little bit more trust that they're with you for the journey.
Well, there's no question of Fugazi, and I think my general, like, we were very celebrated for our low door prices, the $5, famous $5 door. What people didn't quite understand that there was a real practical component to it. There was that we were...
You weren't on the hook for a $20
right,
ticket.
Exactly. Our thing was, like, if for $5, we could suck.
Yeah.
It's still cheaper than your parking, right? So it's like, the idea was it was a turn of the key. We were trying to get into a room with other people. So the $5 would pay enough money to get us there, get the room unlocked, get the electricity on. But then the show itself, we weren't forced to entertain or deliver a certain product for them. Because that's not what we were pursuing. We were pursuing experiences. We were looking for the moments. Because that's really, for me in music, there's these moments that are they're transformative, like where you suddenly, like, things line up, but you have to keep trying to get there.
Yeah.
And I think about shows, when I see shows where tickets are 50, 60, 70 bucks for medium-sized bands or whatever, I just think, like, wow, that's a lot of money. And then, like, if you better play that song.
Yeah.
You know, we never use a set list, so we may play that song, we might not play that song. It just depends on us, how we're feeling. And we wanted to have that kind of, we wanted the liberty of playing as we were. I mean, there was a couple of times where things really went south for one of us or some of us on stage. But we'd say we play as we are, you know, like, if we're sad, we're sad. If we're mad, we're mad. You know, if we're happy, we're happy. It's real. It's not a performance in the sense that we're acting. It's a performance in the sense that we are trying to present this music with you people to make a show. And to qualify the low door price, you know, we put our money where our mouth was. We worked only on percentages. So it wasn't like we were putting the promoters on the hook.
Right.
We were savvy in the way we approached the booking. We knocked down expenses, because once the other people involved with the show realize that you're not asking for a huge guarantee, they're more inclined to break down, like, what they're charging, because they're not looking at, everyone's padding all the time. You know, if everybody wants a bigger slice of the pie, then you had to make a bigger pie. The pie, of course, is the ticket price. So there was a very logical, practical way of doing things. But at the root of it was the idea of removing the necessity to deliver, like, a certain flat version of entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To have higher moments, you have to also suck sometimes.
Yeah, you have to be willing to have lower moments. Yeah,
and boy, we had some terrible shows. You know, Fugazi had shows sometimes we're just like, wow, you know. And there's one show in particular I can remember. It was in Wigan in England, and it was a terrible show. As I recall, all of us are, oh god, we always saw it. And then the Sounds music paper in England came out with a review, and it said, you know, Fugazi, absolutely devastating in Wigan. And we're like, they loved us. And who knew? So
you really never know. You never know. I take some comfort in that I can play a show that I think is terrible and people are like, oh, that was great. You know, yeah. They just don't notice the terrible stuff.
I've had the opposite thing happen too. You just have to remember that not everybody's in the same place that you are. They're going to take their own takeaways from it.
So the experience, it's mostly a live experience for you, or what? How?
No, actually, I actually quite love recording too. Mm-hmm. There was a moment with Fugazi, for instance, where the way we approach our live shows, we were able to suddenly understand how we could apply that in terms of the studio. We actually would play the studio as opposed to play in the studio.
Mm.
And that was, I think, Red Medicine was the record when we, for the first time, like Ted Nicely had recorded us the first record. The second record was John Loder in England. The third record was Repeater, and Ted Nicely did that. And these were all, we were playing, but we were basically faithfully trying to do faithful renditions. We did a little bit of fooling around, but not a lot. Then the next record was Steady Diet, and Ted, you know, wasn't there. And we were like, we're going to do this on our own. And we thought, like, we didn't know what we would do, but we ended up going for the democratic mix, right? Which is the bad mix, where everybody's equal. And then, if everybody gets to put their own spices in, then it's like becomes like this flat. Although ironically, those songs on that record, are, in some way, they're the ones we played most. We play those, they're great for in shows always. And I'm not saying anything weird about that. It's just that record was a strange one. And then we came back and did Kill Taker with Ted. And that one was sort of the, again, like that, we were starting to get a little more comfortable. But really, Red Medicine is where we actually came in and played the studio and actually really thought about like how to build sound. Like Brendan and Guy both were really developing their ideas about sound. And I was listening to an enormous amount of dub and just loved fooling with, we had different styles. They were more maybe exacting. I'm very much like throw it up kind of guy. Yeah. This boom, there it is, and so those Red Medicine and End Hits and Argument, those are all like, I say we really rolled our sleeves up. And I love recording. I actually just finished this record with Amy and Joe. We don't have a name for the band, but we spent almost 3 months, on and off recording. And I love fooling around the studio and coming up with ideas. I am aware of the amount of money that's involved. And it's, it's a little bit ridiculous. When you spend thousands of dollars on a 5-second interval or something that's like no one's going to care about or know about. As if they would listen to your record in the first place, Like, I mean, that's the thing that's never lost on me that people say like, oh yeah, but you're, people love your music or whatever. And I said, right. Same time, 99.9% of the world never has heard of me, never will hear of me. And if right now a meteorite hit this house and flattened it, it would not disturb like a fly on somebody's soup. It's nothing. It's all nothing. So I feel pretty clear about that. So I feel like when I get really caught up in a studio thing where I'm really like fixating on this one thing, like it just doesn't matter.
Well, you do have to feel like, or maybe you don't. I mean, for me, I have to feel like I have to at least imagine that there's an audience that might care about what I'm doing.
Oh, there is. Yeah. I just don't want to give it over. I don't want to overemphasize how this, to me, it's not coming from a high, like a God. I said me, it's just like, this is, I trust the music. Like again, like Louie had an enormous impact on me. The records that really affected me were deeply imperfect records.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so for me to try to polish out all imperfections in the service of what? I feel like the two things that people I think serve are commercial interests, which I think are counter to creativity, true creativity at least. If it's just to try to make something that will sell or because the only thing you can sell is something that's generally speaking is already out there because that's with there's no audiences for new ideas. Yeah. That's what was so wonderful about punk. I think we can all agree that like the earliest punk shows we saw were like weirdos, but we were there because like, what do you got? Like show us, you go to a show and you're like, some kids are banging on pots and, strumming a banjo or something. You're like, okay, well, that's not good, but I like the new idea.
Exactly.
So I think that was super important. But then once it becomes like a commercial endeavor, then those audiences, like clubs require music that's either from artists who have already established themselves or a genre that's established themselves, or there's something, there has to be some hook to get the audience in because the audience is the clientele. And that's that. It's not evil. It's not even bad. It's just a reality. But it's not, what I'm interested in music is just in a different place.
Yeah.
Like I'm trying to make songs that answer whatever question I have inside of me. So that's, I'm trying to make something that just sounds right to me.
Right.
And that's it. So I like getting caught up in the studio, but I also know, like, you got to get off the pot.
Along those lines, one of the things that we wind up talking with people a lot about is that push and pull of influence between things that have influenced you and things that you are rejecting at certain points in your trajectory.
You mean one or me?
Well, I mean one, but I'm posing the question to you.
One or
you know,
me. Right? You can edit that in. I was off mic.
I think about the early days being a teen, and I, in retrospect, understand the antecedents of punk and hardcore at this point. But since you were there a little more sui generis at the beginning, were you having that push-pull with, like, musically, I want nothing to do with this, but I'm trying to take this in?
Well, in the beginning, it wasn't, there was no, first off, career, that's a tough one for me. It's certainly the beginning. I know. But it's like, when I think about the beginning, there's no career.
Right.
It was like, it's like a discipline or something. It's like something, like, I don't know why. Like, I started playing piano before I can even remember. I don't know when I started playing piano. I just always just played piano. So something, I don't know what it is. Like, music, there was something.
Did you take lessons?
It's funny. I didn't. I just started playing before I can remember. I had written songs.
Wow.
And then they're very simple, like, you know, three chordy thing. But mm-hmm. I just loved the organization of sound.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just was obsessed with it. My mother played piano. She could sight, she could read and uh-huh. play. She couldn't play by ear, but she could read music. And she had a little baby grand piano. And my dad was a newspaper man. So my parents moved around. They moved, you know, they were both from here, D.C., but then my oldest sister was born in New York. My next older sister was born in Minneapolis. But then they came back to Washington, and my mother was able to get her piano out of storage and set it up. And while she was pregnant with me, she played piano all the time.
God.
So there's the idea that perhaps with her belly resting against a keyboard that I picked up this piano bug. I don't know, because I'm the only one in the family who really plays piano. So I just played piano. I don't remember ever starting piano. I just played. I've always just played. And then there was a woman who lived up the street. I grew up on Beecher Street here in Washington. And there was a woman who lived, you know, 10 doors up the street, so row houses. And she taught, like, kids piano, but, like, just, she was like a mom.
Yeah.
And so you would just get, you know, I learned where middle C was. I didn't even know the notes. I just knew sounds. And then so I learned the keyboard. And maybe got into, like, the red book, that little
Thompson's
thing. Right, those things.
Little fingers to play.
And I do remember in kindergarten, we sang in kindergarten, and I remember the teacher doing, she had a piano, and we did Home on the Range.
Mm-hmm.
And then she taught us the harmony of Home on the Range.
Uh-huh.
And it was like my brain was exploding with joy to hear the harmonies.
It's exciting.
Yeah, I was riveted. So that woman, I learned a little bit. I could read a little bit. And then my mom said, oh, you know, maybe we should go to this other, like, a more proper teacher. And I went to American University, had a school there called Krieger School of Music. And there was a guy there named Dr. Kidd. And my mom, like, I went to go see him. And so the first day I was there, we went into a recital room. And he said, well, so I hear you've written songs. Let me see what you got. So I played him some of my songs. Again, these are rudimentary songs. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they're just simple progressions that worked. And so I played them. And then he said at the end, he's like, well, that's nice. It's not piano, but it's nice.
Wow.
And
boo.
Well, yeah, but it was like, again, like that interview with the Teen Idols thing I mentioned earlier, I was confused. I was clearly playing a fucking piano.
Yeah.
Right. I just played piano.
It obviously is piano.
Right. Right. But then I realized the piano he was talking about had an uppercase P at the beginning. It was formal.
Mm. Right.
Like and this was the first time I started to understand there was a delineation between music of the people and then the music of the structure, the formal stuff. Like, and it was challenging for me. Like, I was shocked, like, when he said that. And then I think I was 10 or 11. So I was taking lessons and learning, and I grew to hate the piano.
Wow.
And I quit playing piano.
What a sad
story. And I have to say, I like Dr. Kidd. He was a good guy. I don't have any regrets about it. I just said, literally, it was trying to enforce rules about something that should be free made it joyless for me.
Yeah.
And I stopped playing. And it took about 2 or 3 years. I just didn't play piano anymore. And I think at some point I had sufficiently forgotten what they had tried to enforce on me. And one day I started tinkering, and I still to this day just do the same shit. I just tinker on the piano, and it's just back to, I can't read. I can read the right hand, not the left, but I can sit down at any piano and just, I can knock out a tune, no problem. And it's funny, I also, piano was never going to be a rock and roll instrument for me.
Yeah.
Ever. I couldn't see how that would work. So I tried to learn how to play guitar when I was 13. I was obsessed with Jimi Hendrix at this point. Just mm-hmm. loved, I'd seen Monterey Pop, and Woodstock was very important for me. I used to sit, the triple album of Woodstock, the triple gatefold record where you open it up and there's like the crowd, the whole inner, the picture on the inside is just a panorama of the crowd. And I would set that up like on its, you know, so you have the triple gatefold open. So I'd lay my head in between two speakers with the thing in front of me and just look at the crowd and just listen over and over and over to 10 Years After and Jimi Hendrix and all that stuff. And just so into that and just wanted to be like, I just thought it seemed so powerful. And I believed like the Woodstock mythos. I was young. And I thought like, this is like music and these people, like they're changing the world. And that's what I want. I want to be a part of that. You know, that's what I, and when I was a kid, I would drive my parents. We used to go to Connecticut to the house. We have a house in Guilford. My grandparents had a house up there and we would drive up and down on vacation. And I would travel with like a notepad scouting for location for the festival that I would have and making lists of bands who were going to be on my bill. Wow. Mountain was always on the bill.
Yeah, sure. Mountain's always on the bill.
But just thinking, it was just, I just loved the idea of doing festivals. So I tried to learn how to play guitar, and then my mom hired a neighborhood guy, this guy, Nicky Bazanka.
Nicky B.
Nicky Bazanka. And he was a tough guy. And my mom told me later, one of the reasons she hired him to teach me was that, not that he wasn't really a guitar teacher, but he could play guitar, but he was a tough guy, and she wanted him to know me by my first name because then he wouldn't pick on me.
Oh,
right, because he was a tough guy.
This is a little far afield, but that's a really interesting thing, because if you're picking on someone, you're going Makai,
right?
Leo, man, right. You know, you're not going Amy,
right?
You know, that carries a real different kind of bite. There's no bite, you know.
She's pretty brilliant on that front. Right. That was exactly. Yeah. She's like, I saw it, like if you get to know you, and we were always good. I mean, he's now since died, but I know his sister still. I mean, they were a family on that block. Yeah. I knew them. They were you know, rock'em sock'ems. And he tried to teach me. I had bought a guitar at a garage sale for like $10. I had the strings an inch and a half off the neck.
Yeah, of course.
And beyond that, if one is a piano player and then you pick up a guitar and you try to transpose, it doesn't make any sense.
No.
Like, wait, you can have the same note on two different strings? Right. That just does not process
at
all.
It's quantum initially.
Right.
You know,
it's completely weird. But he taught me how to play Smoke on the Water on one string. And that I could do.
Right.
Or I could figure that part out. I realized right then and there, like, this is a pointless exercise. I'm never going to be able to play guitar. Like, I'm never going to be able to do like Led Zeppelin or Jimi Hendrix, all these people. Like, that level of music was so in the clouds. It's like, you know, it'd be like if you built a go-kart and you're thinking like you're going to be a Formula One driver. Yeah. There's no relationship. There are two different worlds. And I really just gave up on the idea. I had no one around me to tell me otherwise.
Because
there was nobody in my family are really musicians. My parents certainly are not in the music business. Nobody knew anything. So I just became a skateboarder.
Yeah.
And then I skateboarded. I mean, and that's how I met, Roy Henry, Garfield, and, you know, Rollins. We were met, I was 11, he was 12. And we just skated all the time. But skating teaches you to redefine the world around you.
Mm-hmm.
And you just start to, it's a whole other level of like looking at the world. So then in high school, punk rock shows up. And as soon as that hit me, I was like, first off, I know how to redefine the world around me.
Yeah.
I've been trained by skateboarding. And second off, after seeing the first show, which is this poster right here, The Cramps, right? February 3rd, 1979, Hall of Nations, and seeing them play and seeing Ivy pick out these songs to one string, I'm like, I can do that.
Yeah.
That I can do.
Yep.
So badass. And then, so when we formed the first band, it was a high school band, the Slinkies. I'd never played any instrument other than piano. And they said, one of the guys had been in a band, he'd sung, another guy had played guitar. Jeff had played the school orchestra, he played percussion of some, you know. And then I said, well, I can play Smoke on the Water on the one string. Yeah. I'm in. I'll play bass.
Yep.
And that's really, and once I started playing bass, but like anything else, like once you, just do it.
Once
do
you
it,
do it.
Do it.
Yeah.
Just keep playing. And then you start understanding, well, wait, these two notes sound good because that's harmony. Like you start finding the notes, how these two notes on the bass sound good together, how you can make a chord, you know, and then you start, And then it just, you know, I've taught myself everything from there. Like just
well, the more you do it, then yeah. you're then what you're doing is practicing. I mean, the world.
It's not dissimilar to your bass. This is my story
because I couldn't really, you know, I could play a few chords on an acoustic guitar, but I couldn't really play, and I didn't really have any talent. But like when you know this sort of punk new wave scene rolled in, I was like, I can be a part of this.
Sure.
I can fit in somewhere because. People are experimenting and they don't care about your, you know, your proficiency level. And you can just, you literally can do anything. You can write songs about any crazy thing or have it be one chord or not really a chord or weird rhythms or playing hubcaps. And that was my entree. I would not have been a musician otherwise.
Exactly. But the thing is, we were musicians
yeah.
in the realest sense. And that's the difference between the capital P and the lower P in piano.
Yeah.
Like, there's the music that is like the career, like the idea of it being a business. Like, I'm a musician. I always say, I'm not a musician. I'm a punk, you know. But really, the truth is, like, music.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I mean, you may have heard me say this before. It's the form of communication that predates language.
Yeah.
This shit is for real. So that's how I'm approaching it. Like, I always just, people say, God, you haven't really been playing much. Oh, contraire.
Yeah.
I play every day.
Wow.
Now, I may not play in front of the people.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean I'm not playing music.
Yeah.
That just means I'm not performing in front of other people.
Yeah.
But I think about, since I got involved with music, with punk rock, I don't think there's been a single day in my life where I haven't thought about music.
Yeah.
Like it just, or if I haven't heard it, I've thought about it. Like, you know, if I haven't played it, I've heard it. If I haven't heard it, I've thought about it. Like it's just all around me. And it's never, it's in, like just now, like when we walked in the room, I said, oh, you got to hear this Prince Farai thing. Like, I just came across that, and I'm so excited to hear, like, the tonality of it, like, the effect, the way it sparks my imagination, and it gives me hope, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, always infinite hope. Music is, because it's always, like, even though that's an old recording, what it tells me is that if you give people instruments and sounds and moments, they're going to, eventually, something incredible is going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's, and that's what was so great about punk, is that there's a lot of people who were not permitted, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But they had the vision, and they didn't get blocked by the permit like process.
Yeah.
You know, if you go to DC public schools, you learn, like, you never ask for permission because the answer is always no. That's a bureaucratic structure, right? And the great thing about punk was, like, you just didn't ask permission.
Yeah.
So I remember when we first started the Slinkies, that band, we immediately started writing songs.
Yeah.
And my friends in high school at that time, this is in the late 70s, there were some high school bands, but all of them did covers. That's yeah. what they did. You play a party and you do Jumpin' Jack Flash and your version of Dust in the Wind or whatever, you know. Then, yeah. And
it's fun. It's a good party song.
Right. But then, yeah. But we wrote our own songs. So people, so if I'd say, oh, we have a band. And then the people would say, oh, so what covers do you do? Oh, we don't do any covers, you know. And they're like, what? You're writing your own songs? That's weird. Like, you're weird. But I loved it, you know. And ironically, we did Stepping Stone, of course,
right.
which I thought was a Sex Pistols song. I had no idea the Monkees, it was a Monkees song. Early on, I remember being at Yesterday and Today Records, which is our local record store that was like the fountain of information, like where I learned so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just go up to the counter and this guy, Skip Groff, who just recently died, Skip would be back there and I'd say, hey, what's this sound like? And then he'd give me an answer. And once I showed him this record and he's like, oh, you know, kind of Velvet Underground-ish. I'm like, okay. And I walked back to the rack and I'm like, I have no idea. What is that? I thought May meant a lot of very soft bass.
Right, right.
I was like, Velvet Underground, like soft bass. Or conversely, I remember when Black Flag, they first came to Washington in February of 81 and they stayed, like I still lived at home and they stayed at my family's house. They were there for 2 or 3 days, sleeping on the floor, you know, Robo the drummer, smoking cigarettes with my mom and having pancakes, you know, it was really good times.
Sounds good.
It was great. So then when they left, they're, you know, getting loaded up and we're all in the street talking like, yo, have a great tour. And it's the first time I'd ever seen a band actually leaving on tour, right? Because I'd never just, and then we were sort of chatting about, you know, or leaving to go back on tour really. And so I said, so like, what do you guys listen to in the van? And they said, you know, a lot of Sabbath and Stooges. And I was like, oh, okay. And I'm like, Sabbath? I think it's Black Sabbath. I think I've heard of Black Sabbath. I'm like, but They have recordings of the Three Stooges? I had no idea who the Stooges were. This is what I love so much about that era. I was always, my mind was just being blown time and time again because I just learning so much. So a lot of the stuff, we just thought the Sex Pistols wrote No Fun. Mm-hmm. We thought they wrote, we just didn't know. We didn't know the difference.
Yeah.
But it didn't. Ultimately, it didn't really matter because now there are songs now.
Yeah.
And we wrote a song called I Drink Milk, which was really like
fantastic.
A slap back to all the kids in our high school just wanted to go to Keggers. And we're like, I drink milk. I drink milk for the vitamin A.
I love it.
You know?
That's so fantastic.
But you could do anything you want. And that was really the magic of the arrangement. And it still is.
Yeah.
It still is if you want it.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with more Art of Process.
The Art of Process is brought to you in part by Myro.
Naturally effective deodorant that looks as good as it smells. Now, Amy, I have been using Myro for a little while now. This is a very punk episode, so I'm just going to let you in on a lot of my...
I need to be let in on your whole deodorant and sweating parameters.
Well, A, I sweat a lot, and B, given the types of shows that I played for many, many years, I sweat even more than I normally would. I would get on stage...
You're a sweater.
Yeah, I'd get under the lights, and it would just go... I would just gush, basically, you know?
Yeah. Ew.
We've established...
A full body gush.
Yeah. But... You know, in the crustier parts of the punk scene of the 80s and 90s and a lot of the sort of punk house potlucks and things, I got to actually appreciate... Look, there was a thing going around Twitter a couple of weeks ago about deodorant and lotion and washing your legs and all these hygiene things, and I get why people who are not privileged white hippies with white dreadlocks are mad at white hippies with white dreadlocks who are like, why would you use deodorant, man? Just be natural and get out there. But I have to say, I did spend some time with a large contingent of people who did not use deodorant. And maybe it's just Stockholm syndrome or something, but you know, I can tell when someone cooks with a lot of garlic or a lot of cumin.
Oh.
And it's not really a problem for me. I'm kind of into
it. This is a getting real situation.
I'm kind of into it. That said, I also am, I have a lot of shame about myself and all of the things that make up my body. And I care a lot about people around me. So I have always been one for deodorant.
Yeah, I've never smelled garlicky cumin on you.
Thank you.
Coming through your pores, I have to say.
Well, now here's the real test as regards our sponsor, Myro. We spent a long couple of days in the car and at the Max Fun Con a week or two ago in close proximity. It was hot in the Los Angeles area.
True.
Did you smell anything emanating from me that you did not appreciate then?
Ted, you smelled fresh as a daisy, is what I'm going to say.
Would you say maybe that if I smelled like anything, it was... vetiver, patchouli, and geranium?
That's exactly what I would say. Yeah, you had a very nice scent, and I did not even think to ask you if it was the sponsor's deodorant.
I wanted to make it a little bit of a blind.
No, I'm very pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, I wanted to make a little bit of a blind test. Yeah. I was using Myro weekend. I got the, as I said, the vetiver, patchouli, and geranium blend. It worked great. It's all natural, all plant-based. Essential oils and natural scents that keep fresh over time. And one of the greatest things about it is that when you sign up for the Myro subscription, you get a deodorant dispenser, I guess you would call it. A capsule. It's well-designed. Seems like a dodecaxanol. It's like 10-sided or 12-sided. So it's easy to hold. And you pop your cartridges and refills in and out of it. So it saves on plastic. Like I saw that and I thought, what an amazing idea. How has nobody ever done this before?
Finally, I know. Finally. And so you have the choice of five different scents. You can get one case and one pod in your $10 starter kit to try for 30 days. Refill pods are delivered to you on a regularly scheduled basis. Press pause or cancel refills anytime.
And again, that case, the pod case is refillable. When you run out and you pop your new one in, you're not adding to another landfill. It's great.
You can get 50% off your first order and get started today for just $5. Visit mymyro.com/art and use promo code ART, A-R-T.
That's mymyro, mymyro.com/art and use promo code ART.
And what's nice about not being technically good enough to play covers is that you are forced to write your own stuff.
Right.
But then you're forced to write your own stuff, and then you're, it really is a more creative experience.
And there's another component, which is another thing which I think is very important about what I love about, I don't want to say young bands in the sense that necessarily they're young people, but quite often they are. Speaking from my own experience, and I think you guys probably can relate, when you start, bands start playing, in their mind, they are sounding like some band they love.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But obviously, like, their relationship with their instruments are nothing to do, you know. I mean, most famously, there's a band, the band Void, who somewhere they thought they were like a heavy metal band. You know, they were kind of like, some point they were like, we're kind of like Rat or something, you know, whatever. They had this sort of idea. But meanwhile, their relationship with their instruments was so specific to them and so peculiar that it made a new form. And that's what I really love, because bands who think that they sound like something, but in their attempt to replicate it, they shit out something so perfect and beautiful that you're like, that's it. You know, like, it's funny, like, in knowing I've known Ted for many, many years, and we've talked a lot about music, and every once in a while he'll drop a little something, like something that he really liked as a kid, and I'm like, oh, like, now I understand that. Doesn't make any sense to me, but I understand it now, you know. Like, it's, and it's deep when you hear people's roots. Like, I remember I was a big Ted Nugent fan in the 70s. I was a skateboarder, and I listened to a lot of Double Live Gonzo, which I thought was like a perfect record. And which is, you know, it's ironic, I know. But I remember Fugazi.
Now it's ironic.
Yeah. But that record was so deep for me. And then, you know, Fugazi, we would tour. We would make tapes for the road, like, you know, the comp tapes. And we had a couple. We'd make these. There's a very, like, a tape called Queen Bee, which was all, we're all Queen fans. Which actually, Queen was the first, Queen Thin Lizzy, my first ever gig. January 77. We're a huge Queen fan. So Guy had made a Queen tape called Queen Bee. And we just would listen to it over and over and over. And so we would make these, like, Eno Ono. Once I was Brian Eno, the other side was Yoko Ono.
You know,
like,
so great.
Right. So we'd have the, so I made one called I, Ted, right, which was just all Nugent stuff. So I put it in, and we're, like, in for, like, maybe 20 minutes in the tape, and they're like, you have to take this off. And it wasn't, I don't think it was so much that they couldn't stand the music, but they could hear, like, elements of my, like, things, guitar, like, feedback things. They're like, all right, probably best. You're starting to show too much of your underwear.
Well, one of the things we talk about is the role of imitation when people are first starting out, that there's things you consciously are trying to imitate, you know, which blend with another thing you're trying to imitate, and how that just gets filtered through your own thing. To me, that's really fascinating. And I agree. Like, I think the less proficient, like, you are, the more interesting that filtering is.
And then sometimes with bands, the closer they get to actually achieving what it was they were heading toward in the first place, it becomes unlistenable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's, you can think, there's like scenes, I'm sure you and I could think about, like, there's scenes where, I thought a lot about this with the hardcore scene, because that was so raw. So all the kids who were making these, like, hardcore, early American hardcore punk bands, they're like just coming up with this stuff. But you didn't know what was in the well, what they were drinking from, you know? It wasn't, you couldn't really tell yet, because it was still raw. And in the rawness, it was beautiful. But then as they got a little more acquainted with their instruments and became more formalized, then kind of what they were, where they're coming from starts, they're, like, start able to replicate more and more. And then it's like, it just became bad. And there's so many terrible second albums of great American punk bands. And of course, early American underground punk scene, the regionality was so distinct,
it was
right?
That was a big factor.
But it's also, but what you're saying is true, though, about how in the initial burst, it was almost in the second iteration that the regionality comes to the fore. Because if you think about, you know, even all the early Boston, the SSDs and the Gangrene you know, people that you know, and Proletariat and all that, early on, they were all very distinct in their own ways.
Of course.
And then this coalescing happens.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
But it's interesting, like, you're Richmond, right?
Yeah.
So, like, in early Richmond, there was, like, a really distinct scene of bands, right? You know, obviously, there was, like, was Beaks from down there? I think they were Beaks. And then there was, like, White Cross and those kind of bands that were those early bands. And then there's a sort of generation, but it's really specific. Like, that's, like, a Richmond thing. And Austin, Texas had a really specific, like, you know, the Dicks and the Big Boys and the Offenders. But there's all these, you know, bands that came out of that scene. every area had these really distinct music styles. And then as they, the more able they were to actually manipulate their instruments in a way that they could replicate other things, you started like, oh, I get it. That's what you were hearing.
Yeah.
I love, I, in some way, I loved it, but it's also made for less interesting music.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah. Show like showing your bones versus showing your underwear, you know?
Right. Right. But I think also in the beginning of when people first start playing music, they're just laying it out there.
Yeah.
Because they don't know how to cover. You can't act when you're just feeling. Like, you know, you just, and it's later when it becomes more of a, well, I got to be who I said I am or whatever. It's weird. It's also interesting. There's a, I didn't realize this till years later that within music, there is a honored tradition of reinvention.
Mm-hmm.
And I just never thought, cause I'm not, so not me. Like I, you know, I am pretty much who I am, like on stage, off stage, I'm just me. But it was Jim Cohen who did, he did this movie with us, Instrument. You know, he directed and we worked with him, we made this movie. And at some point he was having lunch with some other directors or something who also worked on Rock Docs. And they said, so what are those guys really like? And he goes, what, Fugazi guys? He's, he's like, that's what they're like. And they're like, no. But I mean, I know, but that's what they're like. But what are they like when they're not doing like? He's like, that's exactly what they're like. And the other director said, well, that's weird. That's really weird because the whole point of rock and roll is to reinvent yourself. Like Jim, you know, Iggy or Jim Morrison or David Bowie, Bob Dylan.
Or Bob
like,
Dylan.
Like, right, all these people, like these characters, you know, like this other director was like, no, that's like that. The whole point is to create a persona in which you, that is the person who performs. And then you're liberated by that. And I had never, it never occurred to me that that was what people were doing.
So I think I've come from the same place that you do with that. Don't you ever find yourself seeing someone who has so confidently created and cultivated this persona and the way that they're able to pull it off as a performance and think, God, I wish I could approach that kind of thing.
I can sometimes respect it, but I can't take it seriously.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many, I mean, there's people, I respect them. I think that they're doing good for the world. There's nothing, I'm just saying for me personally, I'm really interested in, I just want the real thing.
You want
that's
to
just,
know
so, I just
want
to, I just, and I think that they actually have the real thing, but part of what their real thing is that they're actors, you know, like on some level, which is like, I can appreciate going to see a movie and I believe the character, like I see a movie, I'm like that person, you meet actor people and you know, and then you're like, you think like, oh, you want to meet them because they're so interested. And then you actually meet them. They're like, and they're perfectly nice, but
they're not
like,
them.
No, of course not. And I respect the shit out of that. I really respect it. But I think with music, what I'm looking for in music is something that is much more real. Like and just saying that I just wanted to feel like it is what it is. Actually, I had a friend once who said like, what you want is the truth.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, that's what I that's what I want.
Yeah.
What about as a performer, as a musician, the idea of persona insulating you from, whether it's the, I mean, literally insulating you from interaction with fans that you might not want to have, like insulating you from the ramifications of what you put out into the world, you know, if you're
yeah, but then you also have to take responsibility for those things. Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
If you think about, there's certain people I can think of, like bands I can think of who wear a lot of, say, makeup.
Yeah.
People who have like, they sold millions and millions and millions of records wearing costumes and makeup.
Yes.
And their behavior is atrocious.
Right.
And they somehow, I feel like they have some license, you know, based on the fact that they can hide behind their, I think you're right.
Yeah.
And I think, so for me, like, I don't think the insulation goes both ways.
Mm-hmm.
If you're protected by the effect of your actions on people, then you maybe aren't going to be thinking about it either. Like, I feel like you should be able to navigate the world you live in. And if you're making something that you need to be protected about, then maybe you should think twice about what the fuck you're making. Right? If you're making music that makes people go crazy and want to kill you, maybe you should think about that. Because if not going to kill you, they may kill somebody else.
Right.
And for those of us who experience, like, say, for instance, like the oi world, like the skinhead world, which was, you know, the skinheads in the 80s was, like, their behavior was insane. And most of that behavior was a construct of the song they're singing about, like how persecuted they were, you know, and how this is what they had to go up against, this working class crew. And some of it was may have been true, maybe, but it certainly does not justify the kind of untethered violence and hatred that they've responded with.
Literally, you know? Extrapolate that to a Trump rally.
Exactly. And so I feel like that there's some responsibility that artists have. Like, I do actually have a sense of responsibility to the audiences I play for.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But, if people said to me, well, God, your shows, you're often calling people out for fighting. I said, yeah. I said, I mean, some interview, I said, it'd be like if I had a bunch of people over for dinner and then somebody started stabbing somebody, I'd be like, please stop. Yeah. You know, like, excuse me.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Yeah. Excuse me. You with the hat, you with the baseball hat, could you stop stabbing that person next to you? It just seems so obvious to me. It just seems like the thing to do. In 2002, Fugazi was on tour in England. We'd played a show in Leeds. We were there right around Halloween. And before we were in Leeds, we were in Northern Ireland, where they have, I didn't know this, they have a deep tradition of Halloween costume. They wear a costume. They go out, trick-or-treating or something. Wow. So we were stopping at a petrol station, and Guy went in to get a drink or something from the shop, and he came out and he had bought four of these really grotesque plastic masks. They're just weird, you know, faces with the axes cut through them, whatever, just, and they're like a pound each or something. So he bought us, everyone got one, maybe five or six of them, I don't remember. So we had them in the car, we were laughing. And then we were in Leeds the next day or 2 days later, and we had a great show. We were playing, it was a great set. We had like one encore and another encore, and they were calling for another encore. And we decided we were going to do with this instrumental, which is arpeggiator, I think. And as we were going to the door, we should wear the masks. Mm-hmm. So we put the masks on. We went out and we started to play. And I had this feeling that I had never had before. And I felt it was so crazily empowering.
Wow.
Because I realized that, like, right now as the three of us are talking, we're not conscious of it, but we are very aware of how our faces or what they're revealing.
Right.
That's what all the gestures, that's why we have thousands of muscles in our faces. So when we play and our faces are exposed, we are being read by people.
Yeah.
When you put the mask on, you are free.
Yeah.
It was insane feeling. And I suddenly understood like Slipknot. I understood Kiss and all these people or the Residents, like the kind of liberation that comes with that kind of masking. It was profound.
That's really, really interesting.
It was just one time ever.
Wow.
It was one time I did that and I was like, whoa, I get it. Right. You know, but better put the crack down. I'm not going out.
Well, the last thing I want to ask you about is the new stuff with Amy and Joe and how working with Amy, your partner, and Joe, who you've worked with forever, but how the actual writing goes and how it differs, because I imagine it's probably significantly different from old ways of writing, because I know you collaborate deeply with them.
Well, writing has always been, for a long time, say from Minor Threat, like I would just write the songs.
Yeah.
Like, okay, this is cool. This is a good riff. And this makes, like, oh, this is what goes next. Like, I don't know if that's what goes next. I just know it's what goes next. So I'll put that in there. And then, so I'd say, here's a song, And then, I mean, obviously, when you're practicing with a band, everybody has a say. So everyone, like, all of my songs are credited to all four people because I think they are the product of that band. But the initial structure to the song quite often will come from me, the riffs, because I can't stop writing riffs, basically. So in Minor Threat, it was really like in the very beginning, I would write all the song, and then Lyle and Brian started writing, and they had really different ideas, but it was cool. And I learned a lot. If you're by yourself and then you sit with somebody else, you just learn a lot, you know? And so I was learning a lot. And then, but I was also just singing. I wasn't, so I didn't have, but I was at that time trying to figure out how to sing. I have a really different organization of where to put vocals. Like I think a lot of times people, they focus on where the beginning of the line is, where I always am interested in the end of the line because that sets off the next line. Right. So like where you emphasis is on the end of the line. So like if you listen to like Minor Threat stuff, you can hear trying to figure out how like to make the emphasis on the line by where it stops, and I can remember being in bands, recording other bands, and they would always be like, the emphasis is always the beginning of the line, but then they just kind of trail out the end. I'm really angry because I didn't.
Right.
Where I'm always like, I'm really angry about it. Ha! Right. So it's a different way. Yeah. But this is all organic. It was just a natural, just the way I think about sound. And Fugazi, by the time Fugazi comes around, like, it's worth pointing out that the very beginning of the band, I had been in this band Embrace, which was, it was a creative enterprise, but the other three people in that band had already been in a band that had had a terrible breakup. So me now joining that band was only going to, it was going to break up. It just was not going to last. Yeah. It was just the way it was. And I think all of us were aware of that going into it, but we were all desperate to be in a band. So coming out of that experience, I thought, oh, the mistake was to be in a band. What I really want to do is play music. So sitting at this very table, Joe Lally, he was a kid from around here, and Beefeater, that guy, Tomas, who you, Onam, you met earlier, he lived in that front room there. Beefeater operated out of this house, so they were going on tour. So Joe was going to roadie for them. I didn't really know him. I'd seen him around the way. But we sat at this table talking about music and just hit it off, talking about dub music and the MC5 and James Brown and Obsessed and bands we loved, and just got to know each other. And then at some point, it came to me through Tomas, actually, that Joe was looking to play bass. And I was like, oh, I'm looking for a bass player because I've been playing guitar. I've been playing a lot of writing songs. So I asked Joe, do you want to play music with me? Not a band, just play music. And he said, sure. So we just started playing music. So we spent 6 months playing with a different drummer, this guy, Colin Sears. And then we asked, then Colin left to go back to another band. And we asked Brendan to sit in with us because there was a drum set downstairs that he was practicing with another band here. So he sat in. But I kept saying, we're not a band, we're just going to play music. So early on, the writing was really like, the songs were like my songs. Mm-hmm. By the time we start playing, like Brendan is a very creative guy and he has a lot of ideas. So obviously, and Joe started really coming up with ideas. The songs morphed as we all got our hands on them. But even in early Fugazi, they were largely, I go, here, here's a song, first chorus, all the parts. And then, and at some point, they would just say, well, maybe we should take this part out and do this. I'm like, no, because this song is done. Yeah, and, you know, and it was very hard. Like I realized it, like it was very difficult for me. And I've given this sort of sense of like, if, as if I had built my own bicycle and I rode to practice to show to the guy, like, hey, I made a new bicycle. And then they take it apart and try to put it back together, leaving the things they don't like in it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's not a bicycle anymore, you know? So, but that was hard. And then I realized at that point that the only way I got it, they didn't want to just like play my song. They were like, they're deeply creative, visionary people. And so, and that's when I realized, don't bring in songs because it's too painful to have the songs taken apart. So just brought in riffs, bring a riff in and just play it. And then we'll, the four of us will find the song in the riff. Or someone else will bring in a riff. Then the four of us will find. And then I can add my ideas.
Right.
But it became super collaborative in that sense. And then around In Hits, which is 97, Brendan and Guy came in with a bunch of demos of stuff they had worked on together. You know, they were showing it to us and we were, you know, and I'm just kind of riffing off of him. And they said, well, can you just do it the way, you know, and I was like, hey.
The bicycle's on the other foot now.
Right. But then I have to say that I was like, you know what? Yes, I can. But mostly what I was learning was the different ways of writing. Amy and I played together. We were in the Evens for, you know, years and years and years. And I just, so most of the music or all the guitar riffs are me. She doesn't really play guitar, but her drumming is so like singular, and she has a real sense of music, how she thinks things sound should be organized. And so we would, we have these, you know, we just talk and talk and we work and work and work and talk and talk and talk, trying to find the arrangement for these songs. As a two piece, it was really challenging because you're, the conversation is really between the drums and this baritone guitar. And you ultimately kind of end up being a recital because you're so reliant on each other as opposed to a show, like when you're just really having a musical conversation. Having Joe in the band, having him come into the picture, like he's such an, he's an amazing bass player. He also has a really singular style. So my ideas, like I bring in these riffs, these ideas, and then put them in there. And then we just talk about them and work them. I mean, years.
When you're able to make the choice to work in that way,
yeah,
as, you know, as opposed to bringing in your songs and being extremely precious about them, that's one way of doing it. And, and it's
no, and in all respect,
but there's a different kind of joy. I think I found this in our work, Amy, you know, writing together, that like there's a different kind of joy when you can remove your preciousness from it and look at what you're doing as a puzzle that you're all going to solve together.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
which is kind of why that's why, like, people say, like, why did you play music? Well, I play music for this moment right now, like to have some to talk about. Like, that's what humans, that's what we do. So, like, mm-hmm. For playing music, like, the idea of writing, like, sitting, when people think about, ask me if I miss Fugazi, like, sure, I miss gigging, you know, some degree. But what I really miss is, like, these long period of time sitting in the basement with these people who I love so dearly and just, like, poking at things and then suddenly seeing something come to life, you know, like, yeah. Like, wow, that's incredible. And that's
something new, something you didn't even know you were,
right.
Moving
exactly.
Toward.
And you know, in Fugazi, we practiced, I mean, we would practice when we're not touring, we could play 4 to 5 days a week and we would play for 4 or 5 hours a day. Man. Just play and just talk. And we might talk about Gilligan's Island for 2 hours or something, but ultimately, at some point, when the talking peters out, we've arrived somewhere else with the music. It did what it needed to do. The talking, whatever it was, whether we were talking about something that happened 25 years ago, or if we're talking about something we just read in the paper, or whatever it is, at the end of the conversation, the bread had time to rise, you know, and then the music will come from that, you know. And I really love that quality of time. So when Amy, Joe, and I, Joe's touring right now with Mystetic, so we're not doing anything really to speak of at the moment, but when he wasn't touring, we were practicing 4 days a week at 9:30 in the morning till like 11:30, and just sitting together and talking and playing music. I live for that.
That's as good a place to end it as any, I think. Right?
Thank you so much. This is really great. Thank you guys so much for listening to The Art of Process. I'm Amy Mann.
And I'm Ted Leo. Please remember to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Write a review. If you like it.
Write a good review. Tell your friends. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another Art of Process. We'll see you next time.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.